When you wonder, you're learning. Mr. Rogers' enduring lessons for raising creative, curious, caring kids. By Greg Bear and Ryan Radowski. Forward by Joanne Rogers. Chapter 4, Appreciation is a Holy Thing. Working Together. Summertime and make-believe. On the castle balcony, King Friday the 13th stares at the sun, marveling, perhaps a little jealously, at its withering power. Daniel Striped Tiger lounges beneath an umbrella, half asleep in the heat. Even Mr. McFeely, the speedy delivery man himself, isn't so speedy today. It's just too hot. But there's good news afoot. Make Believe has a surplus this year. After all the road repairs and school upkeep and everything else needed to help keep a community functioning, the neighborhood still has some money to spend. And King Friday has an idea. I'm planning a spectacular addition to our neighborhood, he tells his sweltering subjects, one that may even cool us off. The news breaks like a wave over make-believe. King Friday is building a pool, an honest, real, filled with water community swimming pool. Ellen Patterson of Patterson's Pool surveys the land and draws up an estimate. Relief seems imminent at last. A cool pool, Patterson says, for a hot neighborhood. That's when the trouble begins. Maybe it's the heat, or maybe it's the fact that not everyone wants a community swimming pool. Or maybe it's just inevitable when groups of people and puppets work together. Whatever the case, disagreements and disengagement threaten the pool from the get-go. First, Patterson's estimate comes in higher than Friday had hoped. Then, when the sire asks his subjects to dig the pool themselves, thus saving on labor costs, Daniel Tiger refuses to help. He's worried the work will be hard and the hole will be scary and dark. Lady Elaine complains too, saying she needs new paintbrushes more than she needs a pool. And when the digging finally gets going, the denizens find the pipes beneath Make Believe have burst, sapping the neighborhood's water and causing a very complicated, very expensive Make Believe headache. I need the telephone immediately, King Friday cries as his half-dug hole fills with wasted water. Patterson's pools, this is King Friday the 13th, he shudders into the receiver. I wish to report water ahead of schedule. No, it cannot be stopped by us. We need professional assistance. We all need help sometimes. In 2006, Felix Wernicken and Michael Tomasello, two researchers at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany, were studying altruism, the selfless concern for others that drives some of us to extraordinary acts. Hoping to glean some insight into this strange and wonderful impulse, Wernicken and Tomasello recruited three young chimpanzees and two dozen 18-month-old humans. By comparing the two species, they thought perhaps they could learn something about where altruism comes from and the role that it plays in nature. The scientists presented each of their subjects with a problem. A stranger, usually Wernicken himself, would enter the room and appear to struggle with something. He'd accidentally drop a clothespin, for example, and signal that he couldn't reach it himself. Or he'd struggle to open a cabinet while his hands were full. Although they'd never met Wernicken, nearly every human baby sprang to his assistance. And they did so basically immediately, Tomasello writes in his book, Why We Cooperate. But when Wernicken would appear to throw his clothespin on purpose, or when he'd bump a cabinet without trying to open it, the infants did nothing. Fetching objects or opening cabinet doors, it turned out, held no intrinsic appeal. The infants only acted when they sensed their help was needed. In follow-up studies, children as young as 14 months proved so eager to assist adult strangers that Wernicken and Tomasello had to deploy a distraction activity to keep the babies occupied, but it didn't work. In the vast majority of cases, the babies pulled themselves away from this fun activity. They paid a cost in order to help the struggling adult. As for the chimps, they helped too, but not nearly to the same degree. Wernicke and Tomasello concluded that humans are unique among animals in the ways they help and cooperate with one another, and their drive to work together appears at an impossibly early age. That's good news for the species. More than almost anything else, our capacity to work together has catapulted human beings to our highest heights. It's how we put a man on the moon, brought him back alive, and even made time for a little lunar golf. Collaboration built the internet and the International Space Station. It developed democracy and wiped smallpox off the planet. It's responsible in one way or another for almost all of our modern comforts, and it gave us Abbey Road to boot. We owe it a good deal of thanks. In his 2004 book, The Wisdom of Crowds, journalist James Sirokki explores the power of working together. Under the right conditions, he argues, groups of people tend to make better decisions than even the brightest individual experts. With most things, Sirokki says, the average is mediocrity. With decision making, it's often excellence. You could say it's as if we've been programmed to be collectively smart. Perhaps it's no wonder then that crowds, or more precisely teams, have largely replaced the kind of old school pecking orders where one person called the shots. Today, nearly 9 out of 10 workers spend at least a third of their time in teams, and in surveys after large scale survey, employers consider the ability to work with others a top qualification. Some companies have even hired chief collaboration officers, while others are finding new ways to reward their top team players. The glass and ceramics manufacturer Corning, for example, names select employees fellows, guaranteeing them jobs for life. To become a fellow, employees have to not only author a multi-million dollar patent, they have to help their colleagues do the same. As Rogers himself once said, what really matters is helping others win too, even if it means slowing down and changing our course now and then. Predictably, people who work well with others tend to punch above their weight. You can be the most curious molecular biologist or the most creative jazz drummer on the planet, but if you can't collaborate, you're not likely to get very far. The same thing goes for kids. Learning scientists have long known that something powerful happens in social collaborative settings, partly because hearing and generating language helps forge new neural pathways. The very act of discussing ideas, articulating difficult concepts, and hearing other people's perspectives can rewire children's brains and deepen their understanding. In one study, scientists randomly assigned students to complete a science unit in groups or on their own. After a few weeks, kids who'd gone through the unit and groups outperformed their peers on every single assessment. Even better, the students who'd scored lowest at the unit's outset showed the greatest gains by the end. But despite the proven benefits of working together, doing so doesn't come easy. In 2015, the Program for International Student Assessment, or PISA, decided to test teenagers' collaborative skills for the first time, asking 15-year-olds around the world to lead computerized bots through a group activity. The results were bleak. On average, across participating countries, fewer than 1 in 10 students maintained an awareness of group dynamics, resolved interpersonal conflicts, and led their bots to triumph. Worldwide, just 8% of students qualified as top-level collaborators. Girls scored significantly higher than boys. To be sure, it's difficult for a test to capture something as complex as collaboration. There are so many ways of working together, and plenty of people have criticized PISA and its methods. However, as anyone who's worked on a dysfunctional team can tell you, good collaborators can often be hard to find. This worries more than classroom teachers and project managers. Even Congress has taken note, despite a track record of its own that doesn't exactly inspire confidence in its ability to work together. In 2017, the body's Joint Economic Committee released What We Do Together, a report chronicling the decline of American social life. Since the 1970s, the report explains, Americans have become less likely to spend time with their neighbors or to see their colleagues outside of work. Likewise, they've drifted away from the meeting places and institutions that used to bring us together. Mixed income neighborhoods are largely a thing of the past. More and more, our social lives are defined by an ever-shrinking circle of close family friends, our close family members, friends, and people who are just like ourselves. This might seem like an unusual concern for a congressional committee, especially one whose primary charge is tweaking economic policy. But our inward turn has come with real costs. We no longer relate to each other so easily beyond our inner circles, the report argues. The connective tissue that facilitates cooperation has eroded, leaving us less equipped to solve problems together within our communities. So, too, are we less able to collaborate across communities. The result is a fractured society in which people have largely lost faith in one another. Less than a third of Americans now think most people can be trusted, and young people are far and away the most suspicious of others. No wonder collaboration has suffered. You don't have to like other people in order to work with them, but it helps if you trust that they're not out to get you. Sadly, that's not so simple anymore, and it only takes a glance at the headlines to understand why. Restoring trust on a grand democracy-fixing scale certainly won't be easy. But if we start small, that is, if we show kids what working together can look like and give them the tools to try it themselves, then perhaps we'll have a chance. Social research has gathered impressive evidence to show that when people work together for group goals, there are a number of desirable effects on people's feelings for one another, write Rachel Loden and the late Elizabeth Cohen, two Stanford University professors whose book, Designing Group Work, made them experts on classroom collaboration. When groups engage in cooperative tasks, they are more likely to form ties, to trust one another, and to influence one another than when the task stimulates competition among members. Fortunately for us, cooperative tasks are a daily occurrence in the neighborhood, whether we're building a swimming pool in make-believe or behind the scenes in Studio A. Day in and day out, we're immersed in a world where people and puppets of every stripe work together for common goals. It doesn't always go well, but in every case, the neighborhood's denizens make good faith efforts to resolve their differences and search for solutions. It's a higher-minded idealism, perhaps, than the program's production values let on. Though it's mostly puppets and papier-mâché, the neighborhood is also a small civil society, writes psychologist Lynette Friedrich-Kofer, one in which people work to discover truths about themselves as individuals and truths about the way in which they are interconnected and can realize shared ends or civic goods. These are the same truths, experts say, that we're most at risk of forgetting now. And in that regard, the neighborhood has plenty to teach us. The best model for 21st century living and working, it turns out, came together a half century ago in a tiny TV studio in Pittsburgh. Greater than the sum of its parts, Mr. Rogers enters the living room, donning his usual suit and tie. He changes his shoes, as usual, zips up his sweater, as usual, and sings his usual song. But today is no usual day. We've been thinking a lot about work, Rogers tells us, so I thought I'd like to tell you about some of the work that I do. The camera cuts away from the living room, revealing the hanging lights and coiled cables of Studio A. We see, for the first time, the men and women behind the scenes directing and filming and pushing the cameras. There's the famous model neighborhood from the title sequence with its little houses and tiny trolley. There's Johnny Costa at the piano playing Won't You Be My Neighbor. What little existed of the program's fourth wall comes irreparably crashing down. It takes a lot of people to make television programs, says Rogers, stepping off the set. A lot of people, and all those people care about you. This week's theme, Mr. Rogers Talks About Work, has taken us to Washington, D.C. to see how people make stamps. We've gone to the neighborhood dairy farm to see where milk comes from, to the neighborhood workshop to learn how people fix things, and to the neighborhood grocery store where we took a riveting tour of the stockroom. In the neighborhood of make-believe, we watch people and puppets play in a community swimming pool. We've learned about all kinds of work, and we've seen that no matter what we grow up to do, we won't be working alone. It takes a lot of people to make stamps or stock a grocery store. It takes a team to dig a swimming pool or make a children's TV program. Whether we grow up to be dairy farmers or grocers or the Postmaster General, we can work with and help our neighbors. And that can be such a good feeling. In 2012, Google gathered its top statisticians, engineers, psychologists, and others for a singular mission: to build the perfect team. The company had long been interested in using data to improve collaboration, but it had yet to discover a formula that could send its teams to the stratosphere. Project Aristotle, code name for the philosopher who once called the whole greater than the sum of its part, aimed to change that. The project team began by studying 50 years worth of scientific literature about collaboration, leadership, and more. Then they analyzed data from about some 200 Google teams, searching for patterns that could help them explain why some teams thrived while others crashed and burned. It didn't go very well. Some groups that were ranked among Google's most effective teams, for instance, were composed of friends who socialized outside of work. Others were made up of people who were basically strangers away from the conference room, writes journalist Charles Duhigg in the New York Times Magazine. Some groups sought strong managers, others preferred a less hierarchical structure. Most confounding of all, two teams might have been nearly identical makeups with overlapping memberships, but radically different levels of effectiveness. The company with a better grasp on the world's information than any other entity had been stumped by collaboration. And it might have stayed that way had Project Aristotle not discovered the work of Amy Edmondson, a professor at Harvard Business School. In 1999, Edmondson had pinpointed an invisible fuel that helps power top performing teams, the same concept crucial to curiosity, creativity, and communication. It turns out was also crucial to collaboration, psychological safety. On many teams, writes Edmondson, people tend to act in ways that inhibit learning when they face the potential for threat or embarrassment. Where asking for help, admitting mistakes, or disclosing one's ignorance invites ridicule or rejection, team members will generally refrain from doing so, often with disastrous results. In 2005, for example, one survey found that healthcare workers regularly saw colleagues taking shortcuts or appearing critically incompetent. At the same time, fewer than one in 10 felt safe enough to speak out about it. Perhaps it's no surprise that, according to some estimates, medical errors are the third leading cause of death in the United States. But on teams that have established psychological safety, that is, a sense of confidence that the team will not embarrass, reject, or punish someone for speaking up, team members feel safe to ask questions and admit mistakes. They feel safe to be themselves, to voice dissent, seek clarification, and ask for help when they need it. And the learning that results almost always boosts outcomes for everyone. This takes far more than trust. Psychological safety has to be earned. It cannot exist where members see others as less human, less capable, or less worthy of inclusion. It cannot exist where members sacrifice one colleague's safety for another colleague's comfort, allowing racism or homophobia or hate to fester unchallenged. It cannot exist where even one team member feels that he or she doesn't belong. Psychological safety only takes root where deep trust and mutual respect coincide. Perhaps you've been fortunate enough to be a part of such a team, where you felt free from the pressure to be flawless, where you could ask for help, admit mistakes, and even express self-doubt. And if you haven't had the luxury, perhaps you've had the feeling. Psychological safety is the difference between a tough job interview and dinner with your closest friends. It's the difference between speaking in public and speaking to your spouse. Psychological safety can have profound effects on how teams and their members perform. At Google, teams that lacked psychological safety missed their sales target by an average of 19%. By contrast, teams that felt safe exceeded their targets by almost the same amount. Googlers on psychologically safe teams were less likely to leave the company, better able to harness creative ideas, and twice as likely to be rated effective. Without psychological safety, the company concluded, effective collaboration simply doesn't happen. We've seen this phenomenon elsewhere. When the PISA exam tested students' ability to work together, it also asked about students' well-being. How often, for example, had they felt threatened by their peers, insulted by their teachers, or made to feel otherwise unsafe at school? The correlations were stunning. On average, kids who had not been threatened scored 18 points higher than kids who had. Those who felt respected by their teachers scored 23 points higher than their peers who had been insulted. The more students felt safe in a given school, the better that school performed overall. When we work with people who make us feel safe and respected, it turns out we learn better both individually and collectively. We should note here that psychological safety does not mean the absence of conflict. On the contrary, psychological safety can make conflict more likely because team members feel free to voice dissent. Properly handled, however, conflict can improve the final outcome. Just ask fans of rock and roll. Throughout the genre's history, dozens of so-called supergroups have come and gone. Cream, Super Heavy, and the Hollywood Vampires, just to name a few. At best, some of these groups have managed a catchy song or a half-decent album. At worst, well, let's just say there's a reason you've never heard of Super Heavy. In fact, after 50 plus years of disappointments, duds, and disasters, it's become a rock and roll truism that supergroups rarely work. But one group managed to buck the trend. In the 1980s, George Harrison assembled the Traveling Wilburys, a band comprised of himself, Roy Orbison, Bob Dylan, Tom Petty, and Jeff Lynne. Perhaps as a result of his time in the Beatles, when he'd been overshadowed by his more famous bandmates, Harrison knew that for the Wilburys to work, they'd have to address Dylan's near mythical status. What musician would dare disagree with rock's most revered songwriter? Harrison came up with a plan. On day one of the supergroup's recording sessions, he turned to his bandmate. "We know that you're Bob Dylan and everything," he said in front of everyone, "but we're going to just treat you and talk to you like we would anybody else." And Dylan replied, "Well, great. Believe it or not, I'm in awe of you guys, and it's the same for me." Talk about feeling safe, respected, and treated fairly. Even the band's name reflects an openness to errors and risk. When a band member played a wrong note, Harrison would tell them not to worry. "We'll bury him in the mix," he used to say of the mistakes, hence the Traveling Wilburys. The group recorded its first album over the course of a week. Traveling Wilburys Volume 1 went triple platinum, earning rave reviews and even won a Grammy. The band had broken the supergroup's curse. The uniqueness and worth of every human being. Concluding our tour of Studio A, Rogers walks back to his TV living room and pulls out some sheet music. "Another thing I will do for my work," he says, "is write songs and then sing them for you. This is a song that I wrote that I like to sing to people I really care for. Maybe you know it." Over the course of his career, Rogers wrote some 200 songs and a dozen operas for the neighborhood, which were arranged and played live by the gifted jazz pianist Johnny Costa and his trio. Nearly all of the program's music, Rogers said, sprang from the same underlining goal. "All these songs are really songs about how we feel about ourselves," he explained. "If we can help our children feel accepted and valued when they are small, they'll have a better chance of growing into adults who can feel good about who they are, too." The song Rogers sings now appeared more frequently than almost any other. It's an affirmation, an assurance that someone out there likes us exactly as we are. "It's you I like, every part of you, your skin, your eyes, your feelings, whether old or new. I hope that you'll remember, even when you're feeling blue, that it's you I like, it's you yourself, it's you I like." It's a message Rogers reinforced for 30 years, deploying the song at every conceivable turn, from quiet moments in his neighborhood living room to his moving duet with Jeffrey Erlanger. And it's no coincidence that he deploys it now, capping off his week of discussing work. Rogers understood then what scientists, educators, and employers are rediscovering now, that when we feel accepted and valued as we are, we're more likely to accept and value others. How each of us comes to feel about our individual uniqueness has a strong influence on how we feel about everyone's uniqueness, Rogers once said. Whether we grow into adults who rejoice in the diversity of the world's people or into adults who fear and resent that diversity. In the early 1970s, Lynette Frederick Hofer, then a young psychologist at Penn State University, set out to study the effects of violent television. Although she hadn't planned on including the neighborhood in her experiment, she recently noticed some changes in her young son. He'd grown more patient and more expressive. He'd been getting along better with his playmates. And perhaps not coincidentally, he'd started watching Mr. Rogers. "If my child could find such meaning in the program," she thought, Why not include it in our design to see if other children would respond in similar ways? She split Penn State's nursery school students into three groups. One watched violent cartoons, another watched neutral films such as nature documentaries, and another watched The Neighborhood. We selected several sequences of Mr. Rogers' programs in which dilemmas arose and were resolved, focusing on themes such as the uniqueness and worth of each person, she wrote. Each group watched their programs for 4 weeks. Afterwards, Friedrich Kofer found that while children who watch violent cartoons displayed a decline in self-control, kids who watched The Neighborhood showed the opposite. They grew more patient with each other. They were more willing to wait for and help their peers. And just as Friedrich Kofer had seen in her son, the quality of the group's play improved. They became more cooperative, more expressive of their feelings, and more sympathetic towards the feelings of others. Friedrich Kofer was thrilled. She headed east for Philadelphia to lead follow-up studies with a larger and more representative sample, including children from different races and socioeconomic classes. Though the impact of watching The Neighborhood varied from school to school, Friedrich Kofer found that when she paired the programs with a teacher who could explain and elaborate on its themes, kids of every background and circumstances started getting along better with their peers. The key, she writes, is that in the neighborhood, feelings, beliefs, and opinions are listened to with respect. Often neighbors are puzzled or don't understand views that are different from our own. In some instances, this calls for reassurance, in others, it means a series of questions or challenges. But in every case, what is common to each situation is the careful progression and clarification of ideas and feelings that includes all participants. In other words, problems get solved when everyone talks and everyone gets to be heard, regardless of what they look like or how different their ideas might be. When Daniel Tiger refuses to dig, he's not ridiculed for being scared of a hole. Instead, his friends step in to reassure him. The work will be hard, Lady Aberlin tells him, but also rewarding. As additional challenges present themselves, the broken pipes, the rising water, make-believe denizens have come to a consensus and decide together what they want to do. The process unfolds over multiple episodes, a deliberate choice, says Bill Eisler. After airing single half-hour programs for several years, Rogers eventually learned that it takes more time to work through problems and ideas. In the real world, problems don't get solved in half an hour, and he wanted viewers to see that. So in 1979, he started doing those five-episode themed weeks. Research suggests it was the right call. While there's evidence that programs such as The Neighborhood can help teach young children how to work together, single episodes aren't typically enough on their own. For viewers to grasp the scope of a program's conflict and make sense of its resolution, repeated exposure is probably necessary, experts say. Collaboration, after all, is complicated and difficult to model, especially for young children. That's why having a caring adult, whether it's a teacher, a parent, or someone else whom a child knows and trusts, can be so helpful. Such as Friedrich Kofer's discovered in Philadelphia, subsequent studies have found that adults can enhance a program's benefit by watching alongside children, explaining the program's messages and lessons, and even role-playing similar scenarios. Anyone, it seems, can become a good collaborator. It takes modeling, practice, and guidance from a caring adult. But the skills required to be a good teammate can be taught like anything else. And often the best teams are the ones that have figured this out already. Something sacred. Just a short walk from Rogers Studio A, a group of girls gathered in a high bay warehouse on the campus of Carnegie Mellon University. Huddled over wires, wheels, and circuits, they're building a machine that, if all goes well, will crush their competitors and carry the girls to a world championship. Welcome to Girls of Steel, an all-female competitive robotics team that's become an unstoppable force in the world of FIRST Robotics, an international league based in New Hampshire. FIRST pits student-built robots against one another in matchups that look to spectators like part science fair and part science fiction. Founded in 2010 to get more girls into STEM, Girls of Steel recruits members from elementary, middle, and high schools throughout Pittsburgh, whether they're public or private, whether resourced or low income. Working with volunteer mentors, the girls learn the fundamentals of building robots from wiring and coding to meeting the specs handed down by the league. The girls also run the team itself, planning fundraisers, maintaining the website, and handling media outreach and marketing. From the first meeting at Carnegie Mellon in the fall to the first day of competition in the spring, the Girls of Steel have just weeks to build a winning robot and a winning team. It's a tall order. The Girls of Steel come from every kind of background. They bring different beliefs, different knowledge, different experiences. When they first arrive on campus, they're not a team at all, but rather a group of disparate individuals with no connection to one another and no particular reason to feel safe. A lot of the girls are nervous when they first get here, says program manager Terry Richards. They're intimidated by coming to a prestigious university. They don't know anybody, and often they feel like they don't know anything. It's not exactly a recipe for cohesion, nor, for that matter, for winning a championship. That's why the Girls of Steel develop structures and norms designed to build a sense of psychological safety. For the teams to collaborate, Richard explains, every girl needs to feel like she's making a contribution. Every girl needs to know that her ideas matter and that when she speaks, her team is going to listen. Her ideas might not work for whatever reason, but we emphasize that that's okay. The important thing is that she puts her voice out there and keeps her team and helps her team coordinate and create something. At each week's all hands meeting, Richards and the team's other mentors present scenarios drawn from real life, from real problems the girls are grappling with, but fictionalized to be made less personal. This is, of course, exactly what Rogers did when he deployed his neighborhood puppets. We asked them, what would you do when you encountered such and such situation? Richard said. Each scenario has to do with the team's core principles: integrity, teamwork, safety, communication, respect, and inclusion. But they're not scripted. They're not something the girls read on a screen. Instead, they're rehearsals for the messy reality of working with other humans. The girls discuss their potential responses and even act them out, giving each other feedback and building a working awareness of how their actions and reactions affect the team as a whole. It's the kind of preparation experts say that's crucial to collaboration. When conflict is handled poorly, it can lead to disengagement, defensiveness, and a team's eventual downfall. It doesn't take much. The human brain tends to treat every slight conflict as life or death threats. When disagreements flare, the alarm bell in the brain, ignites the fight or flight response, hijacking the other brain centers, writes Laura Dellezana, an author and consultant who's worked with teams around the world. This act first, think later brain structure shuts down perspective and analytical reasoning. Quite literally, just when we need it most, we lose our minds. That's especially true in adolescence, that anxious and confusing country that's bordered roughly by the ages of 10 and 25. Despite their reputation for recklessness, adolescents can think and reason just as well as adults do during moments of cold cognition. That is, during moments that they are free of passionate emotions or peer pressure. In states of cold cognition, adolescents are surprisingly good at predicting consequences and assessing risk, often making far better decisions than adults might expect. It's adolescents, after all, who've taken the reins on issues from gun violence to racial equity to climate change. But as anyone who's been rejected at the middle school dance can tell you, moments of cold cognition can be fleeting. And because children's brain structures have yet to fully develop, hot cognition sometimes poses a problem. When young people are nervous or heartbroken or being pressured to look cool, they're far less capable of reasoned judgment. Common sense goes out the window. And when we, their dumbfounded parents, ask whether they've lost their minds, we'll do well to remember that the answer, in a very real sense, is yes. The good news is that practicing collaboration during cold cognition can help kids work together during hot cognition. That's why exercises like those at Girls of Steel are so valuable. Thinking through conflict in a pressure-free environment can help build safety and respect among team members who gain a better idea of where their colleagues are coming from. The next time they disagree or find themselves arguing, they'll be less likely to shut down or disassociate from the group altogether. It's an approach that echoes the neighborhood. The program modeled the social interactions and the conflict resolution and the everyday decision it takes to get things done collaboratively, says Roberta Schomburg. Rogers showed children that things break, things fall apart, but it isn't the end of the project, that there's always a way to figure out how to bring it together. Maybe there are some changes in the expected outcome, but people never just threw up their hands and walked away. Of course, some conflicts defy rehearsal or reason. For particularly difficult cases, some experts suggest exercises that ask quarreling colleagues to consider the following. This person has a body and a mind just like me. This person has feelings, emotions, and thoughts just like me. This person has experienced physical and emotional pain and suffering just like me. This person has felt unworthy or inadequate just like me. This person worries and is frightened sometimes just like me. This person has longed for friendship just like me. This person wishes to be loved just like me. Reflecting on statements such as these can help team members recognize each other's humanity and approach conflict as collaborators rather than as opponents who have to be vanquished. I believe that appreciation is a holy thing, Rogers once said, and that when we look for what's best in a person we happen to be with at the moment, we're doing what God does all the time. So in loving and appreciating our neighbor, we're participating in something sacred. The Girls of Steel do this by turning to a series of questions, many of which build on the statements above. The question, said Richards, helps team members approach disagreements with compassion and mutual respect. They begin by grounding girls in a sense of common purpose. What are the goals of Girls of Steel? What did you hope to achieve by joining? Then they help the girls express their feelings and needs. What is your issue and how do you feel? What would you like to happen? Next, they push the girls to stretch their perspective and imagine the feelings of others. How do you think the other side sees the situation? How do you think the other side feels? And finally, they give the girls a voice in potential solutions, allowing them the autonomy to work towards consensus and, if needed, to ask for extra help. What are your recommendations to solve the issue? What are the recommendations of the other parties involved? Do you need to meet with a mentor to moderate a discussion? The result is a team that's both sensitive to its members' feelings and safe enough for girls to speak up. That's really the key to making Girls of Steel work, says Richards. They can say what's on their mind. They don't have to be afraid because they don't know something. Instead, they ask questions because they're around people who aren't going to judge or intimidate them. It takes time, but they develop into these incredible leaders who run the teams themselves. And by any measure, they're running it well. On competition day, the girls, all dressed as Rosie the Riveter, set their contraption loose in the ring, where its mechanical arm grasps at the basketballs that litter the floor. The Girls of Steel shout directions to one another, steering their robots from one place to the next in their drive towards the opposite goal. The other team's robot tries and fails to intercept it. Whoa, shouts the announcer, a little too much pepper on that salad. A buzzer blares, the crowd roars, the Girls of Steel have taken the playoffs. The Radical Mr. Rogers. The neighborhood of make-believe has no choice, King Friday announces. It's no use building a pool if there's no water to fill it. The underground pipes will have to be fixed and paid for, sadly, with the make-believe surplus. There will be no cool pool for this hot neighborhood. It will be good to have running water again, the king asserts during his royal best to mask his disappointment, even if we can't have the community swimming pool. Ellen Patterson of Patterson Pools calls in her backup business, Patterson Pipes. Half of Make Believe converges on the whole, helping Patterson lug shiny bronze tubes into the hollowed earth. They set the pipes and twist the screws. They wheelbarrow dirt from one pile to the next. They shout instructions and questions to one another, and at one point they even break for jazz, that most collaborative of genres. It's a colorful crew. King Friday has arrived on site, as has Ellen Patterson. There's Lady Aberlin and Lady Elaine, Daniel Tiger and X the Owl. People and puppets, some black and some brown, some white and some felt, all show up to help. A few, like Ellen Patterson and Handyman Negri, clearly know what they're doing. Others know nothing of municipal water, yet clearly want to help. It takes a lot of people, after all, to do important work. It takes a team to make the neighborhood better. Which brings us, readers, to collaboration's other component. The more a team reflects the world's diversity, In terms of race, gender, ethnicity, experience, culture, and more, the richer and more original and more enduring its output tends to be. Whether the team works in a classroom, a corporate office, a government, or a half-dug hole in the neighborhood. On one hand, teams that mirror the world's realities perform better simply by virtue of variety. As Surovsky notes in The Wisdom of Crowds, adding new members almost always makes a team smarter because the knowledge the new members bring is not redundant with what everyone else knows. On the other hand, that new knowledge isn't much use if it isn't heard or it's not taken seriously. Diversity's real potential lies not in simply bringing more members to the table, but in sharing with those members the power to make decisions, allocate resources, and determine the team's direction. And though this tends to frighten rulers like King Friday, born as they were into power and the systems built to sustain it, the neighborhood's characters discover again and again the mutual benefits of true solidarity. In make-believe, characters' differences are treated as unique assets for learning. Each neighbor is a distinct individual with different strengths and weaknesses, preferences, limits, and possibilities. Each has dignity and worth and something to contribute, Frederick Kofer writes. And from those contributions come the ideas that move the neighborhood forward, often in unexpected ways. There are always surprises about which members of the community will come up with the insight that moves others to find middle ground. In this scene, middle ground is more than a metaphor. The crew working in the hole finally fixes the pipes, restoring water to make-believe's faucets. But with its surplus spent on repair, the community swimming pool remains a distant dream until a new team member steps in. In many ways, Mayor Maggie of nearby Westwood is King Friday's polar opposite. For one, she's a human, one who governs her community not by fiat, but through conversation with advisors and input from her constituents. Where Friday once built a wall along make-believe's borders, Mayor Maggie built bridges. When she heard that make-believe needed help with its pipe, she volunteered without delay, and now she has an idea. For a long time, the citizens of Westwood have tried to think of a way that we could have a community swimming pool. We've even had drawings made by Patterson's Pools. Now, we have the money for such a pool, but we don't have the water. We've never had enough water supply in Westwood for such a venture. Just today, one of our neighbors suggested that we build the pool midway between this neighborhood and Westwood. You provide the water, we'll provide the pool, and everyone from both neighborhoods will swim in it, a double community pool. King Friday thinks for a moment, taken aback by Mayor Maggie's proposal. Here, on the one hand, is a chance to build a pool to make the community better and escape the withering heat. On the other hand, it's an idea that wasn't his. King Friday won't get credit or the praise for naming rights. He won't get to make the pool's rules, and he'll have to share it with people outside of his neighborhood. And though King Friday has lived his life making laws that suit himself, it's clear that such an approach cannot sustain a community. It's clear that kings alone can't build a neighborhood that works for everyone. That, in order to perform a more perfect make-believe, the people themselves have to have a voice. And so King Friday does what he's never done before. He gives up some of his power. Well, he says, all in favor of providing water for the Midway Pool, say aye. The measure passes democratically. Cheers ring out through the neighborhood. The Midway Pool will be built after all, a testament to what's possible when people and puppets bring their unique perspectives to bear on a problem that touches them all. Each person is in some way different from everyone else, writes Frederick Kofer, but similarities bind all human beings together. For young viewers, it's an indispensable lesson, especially in a country that's more interconnected than ever before. Already, the generations born after 1996 is the most racially and ethnically diverse in US history. Meanwhile, new neighbors continue to arrive from every part of the world. In 2017, some 44 million foreign-born people called the United States home, the highest share in more than a century. That's a lot of new and valuable perspectives, and yet you wouldn't necessarily know it from the media we consume. For several years, researchers at UCLA have tracked how well or how poorly American media reflects the country's population. Though the statistics have improved slightly since the initiative began, women and people of color remain unrepresented and every conceivable role, even though content that's more representative of the country typically does better by every measure, including ratings, reviews, and revenue. Children's media is no exception. One analysis found that among children's television programs, female characters were no better represented in 2017 than they had been in 2007. Racial representation fared a bit better, but the bar was outrageously low to begin with. In 1983, about a year before the Neighborhood swimming pool episode aired, a sample of some 1,100 children's TV characters found that just 89 who weren't white. Of those, just 42 were black. Media representation can have real-world effects on children, scientists say. One survey of some 400 kids published in the journal Communication Research found that watching television boosted self-esteem, but only for children who were white and male. For white girls, and black boys, self-esteem tended to drop as television consumption climbed, an inverse relationship ascribed to homogeneous TV casting. If you can easily see yourself in a program's heroes, the logic goes, then you're more likely to feel good about yourself and your place in society. Conversely, if your TV counterparts, assuming you have them at all, are consistently their sidekicks, the scolds, or even the villains, then you might start to wonder about your own self-worth. Aisha White directs the PRIDE, Positive Racial Identity Development and Early Education Program, an initiative of the Office of Child Development at the University of Pittsburgh School of Education. Through training and support sessions, PRIDE helps parents, educators, and caregivers learn to counter harmful messages and help Black children feel good about themselves, their heritage, and their race. If that strikes you as a Rogers-like mission, it won't surprise you to learn that White spent several years working with Rogers himself, directing a program that helped childcare providers use the neighborhood more effectively in their classroom. Today, in addition to leading PRIDE, White consults for Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood, helping animators ensure that the program's characters and scripts are culturally affirming and relevant. It's important work, says White, in a world where children's media still tends to present white as the norm, as the preferred color. Though she's seen books and television and movies grow slightly more reflective of reality over the years, a lot of kids still don't see themselves or their families in the things they're watching and reading. And given the sheer amount of time that kids spend consuming media, about 6 hours worth per day among 8 to 12-year-olds, according to one survey, it just makes sense that they should see people who look like them, particularly in important roles. Kids and families themselves have made this loud and clear. White cites the runaway success of Black Panther, the 2018 film praised for its Black superheroes. Not only did Black Panther quickly become the first ever superhero film to receive a Best Picture nomination, it also out-earned every solo superhero film ever made. But more important than its critical acclaim or its box office success is what Black Panther provided for families. Black parents were so grateful to finally see a film with Black superheroes who look like their children, says White. It's not that their kids couldn't imagine themselves as superheroes before, because they always have, but kids get so much more from a film when there's someone in it who looks like them. It makes it more personal. It's like an extra gift. And when it helps kids see themselves in a more positive light, it's a gift that keeps giving. According to research compiled in a report that launched the PRIDE program, when Black children feel good about themselves and their identities, it can lead to better academic achievement and better problem-solving skills. It's been linked to lower stress, greater self-esteem, and better health outcomes. And perhaps not surprisingly, it's also been linked to pro-social behaviors, helping, cooperating, and working together. In fact, it's important for kids of every race to see diverse characters portrayed positively in the media, experts say. If our brains are presented with many images of certain groups of people posing as threats, for example, shown as criminals or terrorists, our brain almost always treats those images as memories, writes Britt Andrietta, author of Wired to Connect. And those memories accumulate. They can start to include intrude on reality, affecting the ways that children perceive, interact with, and ultimately treat their peers. That's one reason Rogers was so intentional about the images the neighborhood conveyed. Much has been made of the program's civil rights undertones. In one scene from 1969, Rogers invites Francois Clemens, the opera singer, actor, and gay black man who played Officer Clemens on the program, to join him in cooling their feet in a plastic swimming pool. At the time, pools were proxies for Jim Crow, where black bathers gathered, white supremacists left nails on pool floors, poured bleach in the water, or closed public pools altogether. By contrast, Rogers stakes an undeniable position in front of the camera. Cool water on a hot day, he muses, helping Clemens dry his feet. The neighborhood is full of pointed affirmations of humanity, an aspect of the program that Maxwell King traces in part to Rogers' time as an undergraduate in Winter Park, Florida. In one sense, Florida was more diverse than La Trobe in that there were a lot more people of color in his life when he was down there, says King. In another sense, however, it was less diverse because of Jim Crow. And I think Fred, in his own way, took that in and internalized it as something that he wanted to be in a position to do something about. To that end, Rogers introduced Mayor Maggie of Westwood in the 1970s, bringing a black woman in a position of power to the neighborhood. The Puerto Rican actor, Tony Chalrodes, owned the neighborhood's book and toy shop, where he taught his neighbors Spanish words and phrases. The program's guest stars, meanwhile, span the full spectrum of abilities, identities, and beliefs. There was Jeffrey Erlanger showing off his wheelchair, Dolly Naranjo crafting Pueblo pottery, Susie McConnell, the women's basketball legend, and Maya Yenglin, the architect who designed the Vietnam Wall. Day in and day out, viewers saw every kind of person excelling in every kind of role. It's important for children to experience lots of options in terms of who they can be or what they can be, rather than accepting views of their abilities based on what they look like, on one piece of their identity, says White. When Rogers published First Experiences, for example, a series of books written to help children face new, often frightening, early childhood experiences, such as going to the doctor or getting on an airplane for the first time, he ensured that the book's illustrations defied stereotypes and sent children the message that all people grow up to do all kinds of things. A growing list of contemporary children's books aim to teach the same. Seeking out such books is a good first step towards raising collaborative kids, but experts caution that it's only a start. Kids also need caring adults who can help them make sense of what they're seeing and reading, and who can answer the natural questions that come up when kids notice human differences. And though adults may shirk these questions, preferring instead a colorblind approach that downplays differences, such an approach is squarely at odds with the realities children observe. Studies have shown, for example, that kids recognize racial differences as just 3 months old. By the time they reach preschool, race becomes a factor in who they decide to play with. This happens regardless of parents' self-proclaimed colorblindness. Whether or not adults are willing to talk about it, their children are noticing race and striving to make meaning of it. That's why avoiding the topic won't alleviate racism. On the contrary, colorblindness leaves kids to their own devices, signaling that innocent questions are off limits or unworthy of answers. Without a caring adult to turn to, children develop ideas about race based on their own observations, input from their peers, and the media. This doesn't exactly set them up for success, especially when it comes to a fraught and complicated topic. Instead, experts say it's better to discuss our differences head on, even when we find it difficult. Lots of adults find it uncomfortable, said White, of talking about race with kids. At Pride, we have a number of things we suggest for people. First and foremost, she says, is for adults to respond to questions about race the same way they'd respond to any other kind of question. You don't want to signal to kids that they're doing or saying something wrong when they question racial differences. Likewise, the conversation should be calm, just like it would be in any other case. An adult should be honest about what they know and what they don't know. If a child asks a question that they don't know the answer to, they can say, "Well, I don't know. But maybe we can find a book that would help us answer that question together." White and her colleagues also encourage parents and caregivers to be proactive guides when consuming media with their children, Asking questions that promote awareness of and inquiry about the various ways that stories and characters are presented. If you're reading a book together, says White, you might ask, why do you think they drew this person to look this way? Is there another way the author or illustrator might draw this person? What does the author look like? Does the author look the same as the character? Often these are things that children notice anyway. By asking proactive questions, adults can model that it's good to wonder and ask. The important thing, says White, is to not avoid the topic when it comes up, and that includes glossing over it under the cover of kindness. While kindness is undoubtedly important, dismissing questions of race and representation with phrases like "we're all equal" and "we're kind to our friends" can deny kids the teachable moments that allow them to grow. Such phrases don't help kids who've been harmed by racism, says White, nor do they help kids understand when they've said or done something hurtful. I think we can help kids f think about race in terms of fairness and respect instead, she says. We can help them understand what it means to be human and to show humanity towards someone. We can show them, in other words, what kindness and caring really mean, rather than deploying those words to duck a hard conversation. Together with this kind of guidance, media that portrays characters working together across racial and ethnic lines can positively impact children's attitudes towards people of different groups. The more children see others accepting and celebrating and working across their differences, the more likely they are to do so themselves. We know from PISA exams that kids in diverse classrooms tend to be better team players. We also know that collaborating across lines of difference can strengthen young people's intercultural ties, ties essential for building healthier schools, communities, and democracies. Community weavers and leaders. Taylor Allardyce High School is a hulking beige-gray building on a sloping green lawn in Pittsburgh's Squirrel Hill neighborhood, a bustling mashup of cultures, traditions, religions, and food. Its students come from some of the poorest parts of Pittsburgh as well as some of the wealthiest, converging on streets lined with synagogues, churches, Chinese restaurants, specialty shops, and leafy trees that shade the wide boulevards. It's an idyllic couple of miles, the kind of place you'd picture when you hear the word neighborhood. No wonder Rogers made Squirrel Hill his home. The lifelong Presbyterian felt a spiritual kinship with his predominantly Jewish neighbors and their concept of tikkun olam, or repairing the world. For much of his adult life, Rogers lived just a few blocks from Allardyce, the school where, in 2016, a first-year student named Peyton Klein looked around and saw that something was wrong. I was sitting in homeroom, she remembers, and I realized I knew everybody's name except for one. I'd grown up in a Jewish household, and I believed all these things about being welcoming and understanding, but I wasn't really living those values, so I turned and said hello. The stranger's name was Quala. Although Quala was still learning English, it was only recently that she'd fled her home in Syria. She and Klein managed to bond. The girl shared, after all, something that transcends the limits of language, of borders, and of childhood spent an ocean and a scripture apart. We both really, really hated biology, says Klein. We talked about it every day. The friendship gave Klein a glimpse into the challenges faced by English language learners, things that native speakers take for granted, such as meeting with a guidance counselor or getting a schedule change, became orders of magnitude more difficult. So do everyday things like making friends and doing homework. And then there's the added challenge of prejudice, of being teased on one end of the spectrum and being called a terrorist on the other. The insight led Klein to launch the Global Minds Initiative, an intercultural organization run entirely by youth. At its core, Global Minds is part conversational English practice and part cultural bridge, a place where students' voices matter, whether they're from Squirrel Hill or Syria. We always say that diversity is a fact, but inclusivity is a choice, says Klein. At Global Minds, we make the conscious choice to be inclusive. What began with Klein and Quala quickly grew to 10 members, then 20, then 100. By the end of its first year, Global Minds took up a whole floor after school. Students came for conversations about diversity and human rights and inequality, says Klein. But they stayed for community, for fellowship and mutual exchange. At Global Minds, my friends from Ecuador might help me with my Spanish homework, and I might help them with history or math, says Klein. No one is saving anyone. We're all co-creators. We're all building a community together. Over time, Klein and her peers developed a curriculum for building positive, diverse communities, a series of exercises and activities that help members discover their similarities and embrace and celebrate their differences. Each week, members start by sharing their names, their hometowns, and their answers to some silly questions, says Klein. It sets a precedent for the way we interact with each other. We're really specific, for example, about name pronunciation and knowing everybody's name. That might sound trivial, but by having everyone share their name and share something about them, it sets a norm. We value one another. We value your voice. It sets the tone for some really great conversations. Another activity asked members to write down and share four things they bring to the Global Mind community, showing the group that each member has something to contribute. Still another asked members to choose a word that describes them from any language. Students draw a picture of that word, then use their pictures to form a mural. It's really cool to see how we all have some of the same words, like family and community and funny and intelligent, but in different languages. It shows that we have these common threads. And discovering these bonds, says Klein, allows for deeper, more meaningful discussions about difference. So you can ask those questions that you might think are stupid. You can ask those questions you're scared to ask in other spaces, because here we're all human first. Here we're all community weavers and leaders. The community we've woven has spread beyond the Alderdice. It's even spread beyond Squirrel Hill. Today, Global Minds boasts some two dozen chapters across the United States and Canada, comprising more than 3,500 members from 50 countries. It has a staff of high school students who hail from all over the world, an office in Pittsburgh, and a growing list of programs that includes a conference series and a summer leadership academy. Klein credits the organization's success to its multinational makeup. You want people who check your privilege, who can build on each other's ideas, and who can contradict each other in productive ways. That's why we've set the norm that Global Minds leadership should always be 50% English language learners and 50% native speakers. We want to keep diversity front and center. Despite the initiative's growing reach, Klein says she's most proud of the effect it's had at home. Global Minds has helped change the culture at Alderdice. Classrooms and lunchrooms are less divided. English language learners access far more support, and students form friendships across lines that hadn't historically been crossed. We've become known for this project of inclusion, she says. We've become known for being change makers. We don't ask ourselves, what do I want to do when I grow up? Instead, we ask, what can I do right now? It's a question that's grown more pressing and more personal than Klein and her peers had ever imagined. On October 27th, 2018, a gunman walked into Tree of Life, a synagogue just up the street from Alderdice. He'd been ranting online that morning about a Jewish nonprofit that provides humanitarian aid for immigrants and refugees. Invaders, the man had called them. Armed with three pistols and an assault rifle, he opened fire on the congregation, killing 11 people and injuring more. It was the deadliest attack on Jews in U.S. history. Among Tree of Life surviving congregants is Peyton Klein herself. I think Tree of Life was an awakening, she says, looking back on the morning. Here's what happens when someone falls victim to stereotypes and doesn't see the glory of humanity. Here's what happens when someone doesn't have the sort of bountiful empathy that we've been working so hard to cultivate. For members of Global Minds, the massacre only amplified the importance of their work. It only made that holy thing, as Rogers had once called it, more sacred. After the final shots were fired and the smoke cleared and the first responders hung their heads, after thousands of strangers stood vigil on a Squirrel Hill street corner, after the city's Muslims raised enough money to cover the victims' funeral costs, what Tree of Life made clear was this. It's the appreciation of one's neighbor that makes the neighborhood real. Now, the young people of the Global Minds Initiative want to take that message to the world. Listen, says Klein, we're not going to be discouraged by an act of terror. We're going to use this as an impetus to rise up, move forward, do better, and grow faster. We're going to work against this type of hate. We're going to keep it from taking root, and we're going to do it together every single day. What might you do? Helping kids team up. Many creative scientists and writers report collaboration promotes creativity, says Hyung-hee Kim. Homes and schools should provide opportunities for students to develop teamwork skills, methods for fairly evaluating peer and self-performance, and mechanisms to accept and incorporate criticism. Encourage the kids on the street to stage their own musical or launch their own weeding company. Among friends, kids will experiment with negotiation and compromise. Rather than stepping in with rules, encourage them to ensure that everyone gets to be taken seriously and everyone gets to be heard. Model psychological safety by asking for help, expressing your self-doubts, and admitting your mistakes. At Greg's local school, a teacher and her student created an after-school club originally designed for girls to tinker, create, and invent. That atmosphere of risk-taking and embracing failure led one student to speak up and raise the issue of bullying. Her words sparked the Be the Kind Kid movement, which now has spread well beyond her school. How might you too create conditions where children feel safe enough to express their fears, misgivings, and concerns? When difficult conflicts arise, let children know that there are ups and downs in every friendship. Fred used to say, "It's the people we love the most who can make us feel the gladdest and the maddest," says Hedda Sherapin. We want children to know that it takes work to repair a relationship, but it's the repairing that really strengthens it. Speak honestly with children about times when you struggled with friends. What did you do to repair that relationship? How was the relationship stronger in the end? Talk to your kids about the collective effort required to make their favorite TV shows, toys, or desserts. Rather than ruining the magic, you'll be showing them that they too can create such things with the help of others. Do you know how I made this unicorn cake? Well, yes, I made it right here in our kitchen with your grandma's help, but I couldn't have done it without the ingredients, and I had to go to the store to get the ingredients, and the people who worked here helped me find the right things. Of course, they didn't make the flour, that came from a mill. Oh, and before I did anything, I watched that Nerdy Nummies video on YouTube. Talk to your kids also about what and who they are seeing in the media they consume. When the topic of race or human differences comes up, discuss it as calmly and honestly as you'd discuss anything else. We recommend to adults that they practice, says Aisha White. We recommend that they practice having these conversations with adults before they have conversations with children, because otherwise adults will be uncomfortable if it's something that's unfamiliar to them.